Media moguls, politics, and press freedom. In the 1990s, Europe made a quiet decision that still shapes who controls the media today.
Follow the money.
This is the podcast of the European investigative newsroom, Follow the Money. I'm your host, Emmerie Chatinier, and as always, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter and my co-host, Alexander Fanta, in Vienna. Hi, Alex.
Good morning, Emma.
Today, Alex isn't just anchoring this podcast, he's also the author of the investigation that we'll talk about. Alex uncovered how in the 1990s, then-German Chancellor Helmut Kohl helped block European rules that would have limited media concentration. That block gave Europe's most powerful media moguls a free pass to expand their empire without checks or balances. Those decisions, taken decades ago in Brussels and Berlin, helped shape the highly concentrated media markets that we see all across Europe today, from Germany to Italy and beyond. So, no guests today, because you are the author of this story. And before we dive into the details of your story is about media pluralism. Something pretty huge happened recently in relation to that. We saw massive layoffs at the Washington Post. What happened there?
So the Washington Post is owned by one of the world's richest men, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, who has bought the Washington Post more than 10 years ago. Essentially, a lot of people even at the time said, well, this is one of the world's richest men who's owning a powerful company, buying up that important media property to make sure it is aligned with his views. And lo and behold, in recent years, he has exerted more influence as a publisher. For instance, when, you know, like Trump came in the second time, around that time, Jeff Bezos told the staff that on the opinion pages, he wanted only more or less only the defense of free speech and free markets. So very much aligned with his views. When Bezos bought the Washington Post, he invested heavily in the paper and said, well, my commitment is to keeping this paper great. But in recent years, he has been less willing to swallow, you know, kind of losses, and the paper hasn't been doing so good in business-wise. So now the decision was apparently to lay off, I think, up to a third of the staff, which really diminishes the paper's impact.
And this thing of like buying up media out of business interests, is that something that we also see outside of the US?
So that is something that I think we've seen playing out in many countries, in many media spheres, that very rich individual owners, oligarchs, if you will, are buying up media so that that media reflects their personal opinions and also their business interests. And I think we are now in a place where in Europe, you know, at least half the countries in Europe have a situation where the media landscape is heavily skewed. So what's happening at the Washington Post is really mirrored in the entire media industry. And that has, you know, kind of the loss of jobs and professional journalists has really diminished the, democratic discourse, in the sense that there is, less people producing high quality, outstanding reporting. And that is something that, you know, is I think deeply worrying and has a big impact on media pluralism.
Yeah, you have already mentioned some aspects of media pluralism, but why exactly is media pluralism so important?
So you want to have media that really reflects that also in its ownership. It's really bad for the diversity of public opinion and ultimately for democracy if everything is in the same people's hands and all you ever hear when you open a newspaper or turn on the radio or TV or go on a website is more or less coming from the same political or the same social or cultural kind of angle. So what you want to have is many different voices, many different owners, no control of power in one place.
In the specific story that we're discussing today, you talk about a law in the 90s that actually really shaped our media landscape today. What made you look into a law that was made in the 90s?
So the story starts basically when I had this conversation a couple of years back with somebody who worked in the European Commission. And I think we talked about kind of the shape of the media industry and how dire it was and how much democracy was skewed in many EU countries by the rise of the ownership of moguls, you know. And then this person tells me, but, you know, the Commission tried to do something about this. The European Commission tried to do something about this 20 years ago. It just petered out and went nowhere. And I was like, what? I've never heard about this. And I was really intrigued by that. You know, like it was one of the crucial kind of events of media regulation in Europe in the 1990s that was, it has been completely forgotten about, but it has had a massive impact on whatever happened after.
Yeah. So what was this law and what issues was it trying to fix back then?
So the core of the proposal was saying, well, we want to make it easier for media companies to do business in another country, but at the same time, we want to have limits to how much one media company can own in terms of market share in, like, let's say, print or radio or TV, so that it doesn't get too powerful.
But then what happened?
Well, what happened is, this became a really fiercely contested, fought over proposal. It was really a very fierce battle within the commission.
And who are sort of the core players here? Who was fighting who exactly, and what were the competing arguments?
So on one side of the camp were a lot of academics who were really critical, who said, well, we need to fix, you know, kind of media ownership by capping it. And that camp was joined by a few people in the European Commission, Commissioner Monti, who was championing the proposal, and members of the European Parliament who really wanted to do something about this. At the same time, on the other side of the camp were, you know, the media lobby, so industry groups, some of the largest media conglomerates in Europe. And as it emerged, the president of the commission, who was then Jacques Santer himself, was taking a stance very critical of the proposal coming out of Monti's shop. So the fight over this media ownership directive became more heated and heated. And what happened next really, really kind of decided the whole thing.
What happened next?
Sometime in 1997, as I uncovered, something happened that really flipped the momentum against the proposal, more or less kneecapped it. So a fax arrived at the European Commission directly to Jacques Santer from his very good friend Helmut Kohl, then the German Chancellor. So I don't know, Emma, if you remember Helmut Kohl. I think you're not old enough to remember quite how prominent Helmut Kohl was. You know, I was even born yet. he was the leader of the largest country in the European Union by far, and also such a dominant figure in European politics. You know, he was chancellor in Germany for 16 years. He oversaw the unification of Germany. He was such a powerful figure, and he was sending a letter to the commission, to Jacques, and said, lieber Jacques, you know, he was speaking German. and he was writing that he was seeing with great trepidation, with great apprehension, that the commission was trying to regulate media ownership, something which he saw as meddling in something that was, you know, kind of Germany's own business, how it regulated its own media. He was saying the commission better not mess with our turf here.
Was that his interest in it, or was there also some sort of hidden personal interest in shaping
and
doing
so
it
if,
that
if,
way?
If you want to speculate about agenda, so it's quite obvious that you know, Kohl and his party, the conservative CDU, they always had a very close relationship to some of the larger media owners in Germany, like Axel Springer. That was always a strong alliance. So I think it goes without saying that some of the big conglomerates really disliked this regulation, had Chancellor Kohl's ear. So in writing that letter, Kohl essentially gave Santer a flashing warning sign: do not do anything about this, do not engage. And I think, you know, it's very hard to say because the picture from the archives is incomplete. You know, the commission only gave me part of the documents. And many of the people involved, you know, are either dead or don't remember anything. But I think it goes without saying that powerful intervention played a crucial role in, you know, kind of slowing down and eventually, kind of thwarting this regulation.
But how did he have this sway over the commission? Was he such a powerful figure?
So, you know, Kohl was this massively powerful politician in Europe. And I think any commission president, even today, must realize that when the German chancellor doesn't like a proposal, he has significant resources to marshal, you know, voting power in the council, you know, the that the Chancellor's MEPs aligned with him, voting power in the European Parliament, but also a lot of tacit, implicit power, because, you know, as Germany goes, so do other nations usually follow. So that soft power was just something to reckon with. And eventually the whole idea, the whole directive quietly, you know, got first postponed, and then eventually it was shelved as these things happened. You know, that politically things happened a while later that, you know, forced the entire Santer Commission to step down. And at that point, it became clear that thing is never going to see the light of day again.
But the fact that that regulation ultimately didn't happen, does that also mean that the idea of regulating media concentration died out?
The whole idea, this big idea of regulating media ownership, it didn't die with a big flash. It died, you know, by slowly petering out. And the whole idea that something should be done about media concentration didn't really, you know, fit the times anymore. People thought, you know, it was a very kind of pro-capitalist time. Yeah. You know, people weren't that worried about corporate power as we might be today in some corners. And, you know, by the early 2000s, people were saying, we have the internet. You know, media pluralism is no longer an issue because, you know, who reads newspapers anyway?
Yeah.
So the whole idea becomes less and less popular.
How did this regulation that ultimately never happened, how does that continue to shape our media landscape today?
So in 2004, all these Eastern European countries where German media companies had been buying up newspapers and radio stations, they joined the European Union. And, you know, kind of when joining the European Union, they were told, you know, like kind of make sure that you have a pluralistic, democratic media. But by the time they actually came on, there was no European rules to tell them to keep it that way. And, you know, kind of the developments of the last 20 years were, there were, you know, kind of, there was a kind of slow burning crisis in the media industry, layoffs. A lot of journalists in the last 20 years lost their jobs. Revenue
went down.
Because
of the internet, basically.
Because of the internet, basically. So, you know, kind of that meant less and less large conglomerates owning a larger and larger share of the entire market. So we have seen massive consolidation. But then something more special happened in a few countries, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. So, you know, when we look at Hungary, Orban came in 2010 as Prime Minister. Viktor Orban came in and lo and behold, he would change media laws and businessmen close to his party and to him personally started buying up media companies. So, you know, when you fast forward to the present day in Hungary, there's basically no independent regional papers that report against the government's interests because they're all kind of controlled by people close to Orban. Most of the national papers, basically all of TV and radio is now aligned with the government in a way that makes critical reporting there very unlikely. And that means, you know, except for a few, you know, small independent media outlets out there, much of what Hungarians hear and see on TV and radio and read in the paper is being controlled by interests close to Orban. And that is a situation which is deeply problematic, but it's not illegal under European law, even though it has been recognized many times by academics and in EU reports that media pluralism is closely linked to the quality of democratic discourse. So it's very hard to have a true democracy where all the media is controlled by people that are close to power. But still, European law does not in any way reflect that.
And Hungary is, of course, quite the extreme example, but this media concentration discussion has also been very present in, for example, the Dutch discourse. And an argument I've often heard in that sense is also that they say, well, a lot of media were struggling, and by concentrating these media companies, by merging some companies, they actually had the funds and the ability to sort of boost the quality of journalism and make it more efficient, which benefited journalism as a whole. Do you agree with that?
I think it's an understandable argument, but I think we should, you know, it's very hard sometimes to delineate between the kind of the democratic purpose of journalism and its business interest. While, you know, the argument you've just given might be true in a sense from a publishing perspective, I think it's deeply problematic from, you know, the perspective of the question of journalistic independence. So sometimes, you know, a less kind of consolidated market with, you know, less efficient structures might still be better from a democratic perspective. So, I don't entirely buy that argument, even though I can see that its merits.
From this democratic viewpoint, would you say that the fact that this law in the 90s never materialized, was that really sort of this missed opportunity? Was it really a mistake?
So I think, you know, a window of opportunity closed sometime in the late 90s, and it didn't really open again. Just a couple of years ago, the European Commission gave it another go in trying to regulate media. But the problem they were trying to address was in a way different. They wrote a new law called the European Media Freedom Act, which came into force a couple of years ago. And the European Media Freedom Act explicitly forbade many forms of surveillance of journalists. It forbade kind of direct government meddling in the affairs of public broadcasters. It also had a few things to say about media pluralism, but mainly saying this is something that we should monitor. We're going to fund independent research into producing annual reports about media pluralism, but it didn't really say anything about the level of concentration that is allowed. And that, for instance, means that, you know, situation as it is in Hungary, but also in other countries in Europe, it isn't really addressed with the European Media Freedom Act. So we still don't have a law.
So this Media Freedom Act, it's not something we can really compare to the regulation that we had the proposal for in the 90s. It's really two different things.
No, exactly. So this Media Concentration Directive that they were planning back in the 90s, it never came back in any form. It died when it died, I would say, with the letter of call to Commission President Santer. It never came back. But I think this is a very interesting chapter, and it merits a lot more scrutiny, I think, because it was a juncture that, you know, one path not taken in media regulation. That is something that is still underexplored, you know, the many ways which the present could have changed if more decisive action had been taken, and also in many ways how this discussion has not been drawn to an end. Like, is media pluralism, is media ownership, is media concentration, whatever terms you use, is that still something that we should address in a regulatory way?
Are you worried about the state of media pluralism today?
I think, you know, the state of the world makes one worried about how democratic discourse is controlled by a few gatekeepers. And, you know, that's, you know, the tech barons who control social media, but that's obviously also, the people who employ professional journalists. And if it's a smaller and smaller number of people who employ a dwindling force of professional journalists, that still has a material impact on democratic discourse. So yes, I think that's something to be worried about.
Yeah, and then there's also this argument like, okay, it's not just regulation, it's also people. People don't really want to read anymore, or people aren't like willing to pay for journalism anymore. Do you agree with this responsibility on individuals?
I think, you know, kind of individual media consumers have a big role to play in that. You know, they can vote with their legs, as it is said, and they can also vote with their money. The Reuters Institute's digital news report has for many years now tracked kind of how many people in European countries are willing to pay for news, and that figure is slowly rising. But I think we need to get make that more of a thing for people to say, well, you know, it's only going to be a few euros a month, so why don't I actually pay for a publication that I like to make sure that they can do that professional work.
So in a way, this episode is also a bit of an advertisement for our own work.
It's like, not just ours. I think, you know, if there's a news outlet you like, consider paying for it. It does a lot for media discourse.
With that, we'll wrap up today's episode. Thank you, Alex, to join us also as a guest this time and not just as my co-host. And we will be back next week for another episode.
Thanks, Emma.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.